Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Well, the last couple of days we've been doing interviews with candidates for mayor and city council, and we were able to fit in all but one, so here's the last one. And by the way, after that, we'll be talking to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico and to vocalist Madi Sato. I'd like now to welcome Ron Trujillo. He is running unopposed for city council in District 4. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So you're a city councilor. Nobody decided to run against you in District 4. So I thought, even though you don't have an opponent, I'd give you the opportunity to talk about what you think are the big issues facing Santa Fe right now and what you would like to continue to do as city councilor.
Okay. Well, you know, well, first of all, you know, little bit about me. My name is Ronald Trujillo, lifelong resident of Santa Fe and of District 4. Graduated from Santa Fe High. I was also the junior varsity and freshman baseball coach in the early 90s at Santa Fe High, and I've been involved in a lot of youth leagues throughout the community. Well, yes, of course, I'm running unopposed. I'm very thankful for that. You know, I want to thank the residents and the constituents of District 4 for, you know, believing
in me. For not running,
but for believing in me. I think, you know what, I think we've done a lot of good in District 4. When I first ran 4 years ago, one of my biggest concerns was the parks. I felt that the past council made some mistakes when they let the parks die when we had the drought. Not something I would have done, being that the parks, to me, are technically the last refuge that families had where they could actually go spend some time, you know, having fun, playing with a kite, running with a dog, you know, instead of in their backyard. They had the parks, but, you know, that was something that the council decided to do, was let the parks die. Well, when I got on council, that was one of the things. And, you know, with the help of Councilor Ortiz and the rest of the council, we passed the parks bond 3 years ago. And right now you can see what improvements have happened at all the parks. Two of the regional parks are in my district, which is Regal and Franklin Miles. If you drive by there, Franklin Miles should be done, we're hoping, within a month or 2 months, so we can start baseball season. Regal will start work in probably as soon as baseball season ends, so at the end of July. So, you know, I'm very pleased that, you know, the parks in Santa Fe, but especially in my district, you know, are going to be back up to par and even better than they were, you know, 2 years ago.
And near where I live, we have Ashbaugh Park, which is a wonderful combination. On one side, a terrific athletic field. On the other side, a wonderful prairie dog field.
Yes. Well, you know, me and prairie dogs, we you know, I differ on certain things like that. You know, I can just tell you right now, I mean, in Franklin Miles, we had a plague case. You know, I don't have a problem with prairie dogs. I don't hate prairie dogs, but there's got to be a place where, you know, we can have prairie dogs, and a place where, in my opinion, they don't belong. And in my opinion, in certain places like parks where children are playing, they don't belong. And my concern is
we'll have another conversation about that.
It's just dealing. Yeah. I don't want to see a child get hurt. You know, pull a leg, pull a muscle, break a leg. These are, and yeah, no, I'd be willing to come back and discuss that with you. That's something I will. But just to let you know. I mean, I'm running unopposed. You know, my biggest concerns are still going to be with public safety. I'm the chairman of public safety. You know, over this past year, we've had a high crime rate, and I think I do believe a lot has to do with the economy that we're having. You know,
right.
People, instead of going out and getting a job, would rather go steal from their neighbors. Something that I believe is wrong.
And it's such a funny combination. I mean, you have the rise of gangs during a bad economy, but then gangs have kind of a life of their own.
Oh, of course, you know. You
which
know,
is not based on the economy.
No, you know, but, you know, I see people are struggling. But, you know, like with anything, if you're struggling, you go out and get a job. You know, you don't have to, you know, resort to that. But, you know, public safety. I mean, you know, right now you do know that we have started annexing already. We're going to be annexing in 2 years other portions of Santa Fe.
Santa Fe County
into the city. You know, we as a city, we need to, you know, be ready for this annexation. You know, where are we going to get more police officers? Where are we going to get more fire department, you know, personnel? Well, everybody in Santa Fe knows me. I'm the red light camera counselor. I passed the red light ordinance. Everybody knows that we have a speed man here, and the reason for that is because of public safety. Some people here in Santa Fe sometimes think that yellow means accelerate. It doesn't. It means slow down. You're coming to a red light. That is the reason I introduced this bill. I've seen too many people near misses. That's why we brought this in. But at the same time, too, we brought this in with any time you break the law, there's a fine that comes with it. The way I wrote the ordinance isn't at all like Albuquerque's. Albuquerque was having their money go directly into their general fund I made sure that our ordinance went directly back to public safety, back to the police department. So, you know, this way the police officers have this money that comes from the fines to help them in any way. I am hoping that, you know, with this money, some of it is diverted to go hire more police officers, because that is our biggest thing. We need to have, you know, I think we're up to 140 now, but I mean, you know, with the annexation, we're probably going to have to be up to 170, 180. We have made strides, because when I first got on council, we were down, you know, 20, 30 officers. We first got on council, you know, we had to pass a property tax to pay for the police officers. Why? Because we were trying to play catch up. You know, that's the thing that I think this past council that, you know, I've served on has been trying to do these last 4 years, catch up. You know, too many things, I believe, past councils have said is, let's put this to the side burner, let's just wait. Well, you know, what happens? You wait on something, it becomes a problem. You know, and that's one thing I've been very proud of, you know, this council. We have acted on a lot of issues that weren't acted upon, and we've made some really good strides in this community. Public safety. The other thing is affordable housing. You know, that to me is one of the biggest reasons I think Santa Fe's economy does hurt, because majority of the people that from that work here in Santa Fe don't live here in Santa Fe. They end up living in Española. They end up living in Rio Rancho, Albuquerque. A lot of my friends live in Albuquerque, Rio Rancho, and I don't blame them. Their houses they buy, you know, they can afford the payments. Santa Fe is a very high, you know, high-end place to live. You know, me and my wife, you know, we both work for the state. You know, I'm not saying, you know, we don't have these $80,000 jobs, you know, so sometimes it's a struggle for us to be here, but, you know, we choose to live here in Santa Fe. We were born and raised here. You know, this is where we're going to die. This is where we want our children raised. There's no other place in the world like Santa Fe. But that's something that we as a council, we need to find, you know, other sources so that we can keep the people here in Santa Fe, you know, living here in Santa Fe, and not, you know, earning that money here in Santa Fe, but spending it in Albuquerque and Rio Rancho.
Exactly. Ron Trujillo is city councilor from District 4, running unopposed. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. And one thing I could tell everybody, please go vote. It's very important. You know, even though I'm unopposed, I ask constituents District 4 to go vote. So
it is your right and it is your responsibility,
exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen. Thanks a lot, Ron.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Sandy Buffett. She's the executive director of Conservation Voters New Mexico and Conservation Voters New Mexico Education Fund. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me.
So we have you on just about every year during the legislative session. You
Yes.
are basically a lobbying group and an education group.
Correct.
Bringing to the attention of the voters and the citizens of New Mexico issues having to do with conservation on all fronts.
That's right. Conservation Voters New Mexico, or CVNM as I may refer to ourselves, we are the political voice for conservation and environmental protection in New Mexico. And we have a unique role. We work to elect pro-environment champions, and we are focused at the New Mexico State Legislature. And we do that not just because we love politics, but because we want to be able to have a strong voice and ensure that strong policies that protect air, land, and water have a fighting chance at passing over there. So we elect champions, we lobby full-time. We're actually the only full-time lobbyists on all the range of environmental issues at the Roundhouse. And then we keep score, and we do an annual scorecard of how your legislators are voting on the environment, getting a 0 to 100% score.
And some of the people love that scorecard, and other ones find it quite annoying.
That's right, and I just love how some of the legislators act like, oh, yeah, I've seen that scorecard of yours, and then we say, yeah, I think you got a 70, and they're like, I got an 86%, and they know exactly what their score is.
Right,
so
right.
It actually is having an effect of moving legislators, because when they get phone calls, emails from their constituents, if they're on issues of environmental protection, they, of course, on any issue, but what their constituents call them about and email about matters to them.
Yeah, and they're, in theory, at least obligated to represent those constituents.
That's right, and we have varying degrees of that going on, but the good news is that in the 5 legislative sessions I've been at Conservation Voters, I do see a real change where we have more allies, folks that not only are voting the right way, but really are in their core believe in environmental protection. So that's been a nice sea change just in the 5 years I've been doing this.
One of the things that you have been observing is when bills come up, that would harm the environment. Give us an overview of some of those bills that have been, in your view, negative toward the environment and where they stand in this legislative session.
Sure. Well, in this 30-day short budget session,
which isn't really supposed to have that much
legislation. I think we're probably close to 1,000 bills introduced or so. CVNM is tracking 80 bills currently that have a positive or negative environmental impact. And those issues range from GMOs to air pollution to land conservation to water quality, renewable energy, oil and gas operations. So we see the gamut. But just a few bills I want to mention. Just this week, we had Representative Gardner's No Severance Bond Projects in Certain Counties, which sounds sort of
bureaucratic.
It said that any county that imposes so-called onerous ordinances or regulations that hurt the extractive industries would not receive state money in the form of severance taxes. So that could be tens of millions for some of these counties that would be cut off because they're working to protect their communities, the public health of their citizens. And this, I think, is sort of a cynical attempt to punish counties such as Santa Fe County, Rio Riba County, that have adopted common sense regulations and ordinances, such as in the Galisteo Basin fight.
And has that gone anywhere?
There was a vote to table the bill and it tied, and then there was a vote to pass it and that tied. So we're going to have to just maintain vigilance on that committee, make sure that our people, our legislators who would vote to kill that, are always in the room if that comes up. But I think given the clock, that's in a pretty good situation.
Right.
And then there was one, they rescind the pit rules bill, which never got deemed germane. So in effect, it's dead. They found it had no budget implication. And that would have sought to overturn the Governor Richardson's pit rules, which protect groundwater from the production wastes involved in oil and gas operations.
That's a dead one, too. Where did these bills originate?
You know, in the interim, in between legislative sessions, the legislators do, even though it's a citizen legislature, they do meet year-round in committees around the state. And industry brings issues, all sides bring issues that they want legislators to understand, to study, to research to those interim committees. And some of these issues often come up. We are seeing more of a regulatory reform rhetoric is what we're hearing about. You know, Governor Richardson has been a champion in ensuring that his environmental agencies are doing everything that they can to protect air, land, and water. And that has not been to the liking of some of the industries in this state. So they're pushing back. But so far on those bills, though, we can turn our attention to more proactive, good environmental bills now that we know that those are not moving.
We're talking to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico. So some anti-environmental legislation is dead.
Yep.
So let's talk now about what's actually moving in the legislature.
There's a great bill sponsored by Santa Fe's own Representative Brian Egolf. It's called the Air Quality Control Permit Denial. I prefer to call this bill the Children's Right to Breathe Act, HB 276. What this bill does is it gives authority to the Environment Department that, amazingly, they don't have right now, and that is to deny or revoke air quality permits for the most egregious air pollution violators. This so-called bad actor provision already exists in most other environmental statutes, water quality, hazardous waste, and solid waste. But for some historical reason, it's not in the Air Quality Act. So this bill would amend that act to give the state bad actor authority. What that means is it would not affect the vast majority of companies operating with a permit in this state. This is really meant to give the state some tools to go after the worst of the worst offenders that in some cases aren't even operating with a permit. So it says, if you operate without an air permit and you exceed 25% of the allowed levels of pollution, then that perhaps could make you a bad actor. Or if you are convicted in a court of law of environmental crimes, or if you have failed to disclose key information under the Air Quality Act or knowingly misrepresented facts. So this, actually, in the last 7 years of this administration, the bad actor provision and the other statutes has only been used once. So this is not a sweeping piece of legislation, but unfortunately we're facing real opposition to this.
Who would oppose that and why?
Most of the industry that gets air permits are currently working the House to oppose it. So it's gotten to be one of the most visible environmental pieces of legislation this session, just in the last few days. And what it's meant to do is to give the state the authority, just, you know, the few situations where a community is, that a facility is near a children's center, or where communities are getting sick, and the entity is just flaunting the state and saying, we're just going to continue to operate this way.
Right. In other words, we don't care if the community next to which we're operating is getting sick.
Right. And the few cases over time where this has happened, this is not an entity next to Santa Fe Prep. These are poor communities. These are people without a voice. You know, a child, if they develop asthma as a child, they're likely to have it the rest of their lives. And we know air pollution is a major contributor to asthma. So why, when we need to make sure our kids have everything they can get to succeed, why would we not give the state the tools they need to protect the air quality that our children and that all of our citizens are breathing? If you are a constituent of Representative Egolf, please call or email him and thank him for sponsoring this really important piece of legislation. That was HB 276.
So that is a piece of legislation. Let's talk about some of the other bills that are on the floor.
Sure. There's a really exciting development, a bill called the Farmer Protection Act. That's SB 303, sponsored by Senator Eric Grego. And this is around the issues of genetically modified organisms, GMOs. The bill itself actually is very narrow and simple. It just sets up a legal framework. And again, it's mystifying that this doesn't already exist, but that says New Mexico farmers are not liable if, say, a genetically modified seed from a neighboring field of genetically GMO planted fields.
Or if a truck passing by.
Right. If the seed accidentally contaminates a New Mexico farmer's land, that there would be protection for liability for that sort of accidental contamination.
Now, this is something which is hard to understand if you don't know the precedents for this, but there are some famous cases in which Monsanto sued farmers because these farmers' fields were inadvertently, unknowingly contaminated by Monsanto seeds, which they not only didn't choose, but really didn't want.
That's right.
They got in there, they were airborne, you can't control that, and Monsanto sued them for having their patented crops in their fields.
You know about this issue well. And what we're hearing from some of the folks who in the legislature aren't familiar yet with this issue is this is a solution looking for a problem. But in fact, we know, say, from the Center for Food Safety, which has a report online called Monsanto versus U.S. Farmers, they say that as of 2007, 112 lawsuits had been filed by Monsanto against farmers for this very type of, you know, patent infringement issues. So over 372 farmers involved in those cases. It's a 21st century reality of our agriculture. And we just want to make sure that farmers in New Mexico are protected, that they can continue to farm the way they always have, that they have sovereignty over their seeds, that a company can't just, without permission, come onto their land to take samples. So the bill discusses that. And also it provides jurisdiction that if a company were to sue for patent infringement or royalties of some sort, that instead of being back in the Midwest or overseas, wherever the corporation that was suing is based, which has happened in other cases, that this bill would provide jurisdiction that the case has to be heard in district court in the state of New Mexico.
Very so interesting. Does that have good support?
Well, it does. There are a lot of voices coming out very quickly in support of this bill. We understand that, well, Santa Fe County and Rio Arriba County already a few years ago passed resolutions related to seed sovereignty. All Indian Pueblo Council, National Congress of American Indians, and the 8 Northern Indian Pueblos all have some sort of resolutions out on a broader issue, not just on this bill, but related to GMO-free zones and calling in opposition to those issues. So I expect sort of a groundswell of support. This bill just started moving very quickly, so I think we'll see opposition also mounting. But if this is an issue that your listeners are interested in, I really urge them to call their state senator. And in this listener area, that would include Senator Worth, Senator Phil Griego, Senator Nancy Rodriguez, Senator Carlos Cisneros, and Senator Richard Martinez. They all need to hear from you that SB 303, the Farmer Protection Act, is something they should support. It's just common sense. We want to side with New Mexico farmers over out-of-state multinational corporations.
We're talking to Sandy Buffett from Conservation Voters New Mexico. A couple of more bills to talk about.
Sure. There's an interesting bill called the Private Right of Action, HB 259, which is sponsored by Speaker Ben Lujan. And what this would do is give a crucial tool that we currently don't have here at the state level. Again, relating to Governor Richardson's legacy, he's done quite a bit to ensure protection of our resources. But we want to make sure that all future administrations, that they wouldn't have to necessarily roll back those laws and rules, but they could choose not to enforce them. And so what this bill would do is give a tool to citizens to demand enforcement by their state government.
Right.
And this provision already exists in some federal statutes, but it amends various environmental protection acts and the Oil and Gas Act to give citizens the ability to enforce pollution provisions of those statutes. And so
that's very interesting, because as we know, there's many good laws on the books and historically untold numbers of laws that never were enforced.
Yeah, that's right. And so also this gives citizens that might, or communities that might not be able to afford this kind of litigation, it says that their costs would be reimbursed if they prevail in the case. You know, and this is another tool to hold polluters accountable, and it would also then, the court could direct the state to perform its mandate and enforce the rules on the books.
And what's the support look like for that bill?
Well, it's gonna see its first committee this week, but given that Speaker Lujan is on it and several other folks in leadership have signed on to it, I think this one is going to move. And also encourage your listeners to support HB 259, Private Right of Action.
One more bill, Natural Heritage Conservation Act.
Yeah, SB 186, sponsored by Senator Carlos Cisneros. What this does is simply set up an entity. There's no budgetary impact involved. Of course, as you know, this was not the year to bring a new revenue request to the state. But the conservation community, groups that do land easements, conservation easements, have really grappled with how do we get some real resources to bring to the table to ensure that we can protect working farms and ranches, watersheds, and promote easements, all the various things that we need to protect open space and the areas we cherish here in the state. So this entity, again, no fiscal impact at this point. It just sets up the entity, and then we could then start to receive federal dollars. Right now we miss out on $20 million a year for federal grants and money that we could be getting for land conservations. That would allow us to start receiving some of those, and then the entity could also receive private donations.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
It's hard for citizens who don't closely study the issues to know things like that. What legislation even makes it possible to bring in federal money that would be
right.
Well spent.
Right. And, you know, everyone hears about, oh, this piece of land or this hill is going to get developed, and how do we protect it? And this is the kind of entity that would create resources for communities that decided they wanted to protect a piece of land.
Now, once again, what does the support look like for that?
That was actually in the governor's State of the State. It is a priority, it passed with no recommendation out of its first committee, but it's still moving. I believe it's now in Senate Finance, and there's a lot of stuff in Senate Finance these last few days. But we think we still have the momentum on that bill. And on all of these bills, what's really exciting, Mary Charlotte, is this session, although predicted to be just so difficult because of what the state is facing, because we have more allies now over at the Capitol, these are bills that even just 3 or 4 years ago would never have even passed out of their first committee. And now we have four, these are just four of the major bills that are moving. But we're actually seeing bills brought by the rest of the environmental community now have a fighting chance of if not passing this year, passing eventually. Because, again, legislators are hearing more from their constituents that these issues matter when voters go to the polls.
Due in no small part to you, Sandy Buffett, and Conservation Voters New Mexico, both the lobbying and the educational end of that. It really is a fight of the little guy versus, I mean, is there a lot of corporate influence? We hear about Washington, which is a nightmare in that regard, if you want to think about citizen action versus the incredible influence of corporations. What's that like in New Mexico?
Yeah, it does seem like several of those bills I mentioned to you have a thread, and that is sort of a David versus Goliath battle that we face. The voice for conservation is growing, but I can't deny that the voice for unfettered economic development is also powerful and growing. And we just want to make sure that people understand that it's a false dichotomy to say that, we need jobs so we can't afford environmental protection. It's actually the opposite. You know, we know from studies that when CEOs look at where they want to relocate a company, they want to know, well, are the schools good? And what's the quality of life like in that state? Is there access to the outdoors? Is there clean water and clean air? And is it a place I want to raise my family? So it's the very time, if we want to continue to develop New Mexico economically, that we also make sure that the communities that are raising their families here, that they, you know, they deserve clean air and clean water so that their kids can grow up healthy and happy.
Well, there's also the social justice aspect of it, which, as you kind of alluded to before, the places that get most dumped on are the places where the poorest people with the least amount of political clout live.
Yes, that's true. But what we find is that when conservationists align themselves with groups like just people, land-based groups that also are very powerful at the legislature, the land-based groups, the Acequias, all of those folks, they do have a voice as well, and the legislators listen to what they have to say. So when we are on the same page, such as on this Farmer Protection Act, it can be very powerful.
And there's also, finally, the issue that it's not only the quality of life, but it's the viability of ecosystems.
Right.
Without which none of us is going anywhere in future generations.
Well, and water quantity is, of course, and thank goodness it's been snowing. It's been great for our water table and our aquifers. We need to protect water because here, I mean, where it's scarce in the first place, we can ill afford to contaminate a single drop of groundwater. So these bills that we fight, where industry is saying that regulations should be more lax and weakened to allow them to contaminate water up to a higher point. Actually, we say, if you want New Mexico to be a competitive place, we've got to have clean water here. So it's always difficult to sometimes get into the merits of the argument when you're in the final days of the legislature. Oftentimes it comes down to politics rather than policy. But we feel that's our role of making sure that the environment has a fighting chance in the political process. And again, citizens can play a key role in that by making sure that their state representatives, their state senators, all of their elected officials continue to get the emails, the phone calls, the handwritten letters that they demand that their elected officials protect our environment.
Sandy Buffett is the executive director of Conservation Voters New Mexico and CVNM Education Fund. They can be found on the web at cvnm.org. And all the things that we talked about, all the bills we talked about, are on there. Thank you so much, Sandy, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. was ancient traditional music of Japan, performed by vocalist-musician Madi Sato, who is here to tell us about not only sacred music, but the upcoming Santa Fe Women's Sacred World Music Choir. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, ohayou gozaimasu. Arigatou gozaimasu. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm happy to be here today. I've got a couple of things coming up that are very exciting to announce to Santa Fe community. And I've been traveling around the last 7 years back to my homeland of Japan and studying the traditional music there, and been on a very kind of focused, disciplined, spiritual journey through going back to my roots of Japan.
So, sacred music. I've always wondered, what makes sacred music sacred?
I think anything that is with an intention from the heart for prayerful reasons and also healing is considered sacred music. Especially music that is connected to lineage that comes from an ancient place. Most music that I have studied and worked with that comes from, we're talking 1,000 years ago, had its roots in devotional, prayerful aspects of music. So I think ancient, traditional music from anywhere on the planet, you could probably call that sacred.
So yeah. In the piece we were just listening to, tell us about it.
Yeah, the piece that I recorded there is known as Shigin. It's a traditional Japanese art form, dates back 2,000 years ago, and it's traditional Japanese poetry written by historical figures of Japan, done in a chant melody. And it's not really performed much anymore except for the grandmas and the grandpas, and it's very deep ancient music with even a very ancient language that's not used as much anymore.
What does it mean?
It's talking about the revered mountain called Fujisan, and it's that big, tall, snow-capped mountain that you see when you're riding the train across Japan. And it says that Mount Fuji is beautiful in a silvery mist, and the divine dragon has dwelled for thousands of years at the base of Fuji. The people come to pray for the divine dragon to return, and the top of Fuji is like an inverted fan against an eastern blue sky.
So in that spirituality, there's a lot of connection to nature, to mountains.
That's right, yeah. Another thing that I practice is Shinto chanting, and that is also dates back to around the time when Shigin was coming up. And Shinto spirituality is the indigenous and national, if you call it a religion, of Japan, and it's nature-based and very much similar to Native American spirituality.
And then there is that cultural aspect in the image of the inverted fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this, whether you're listening to it and you know what it means or not, it also just in the form of the music and the drumming and in all of it, in the chanting, has some power even for people who are not part of that culture.
Oh, yeah. Since I've been singing this music the past 7 years, in different settings around the world, people respond from a very emotional, deep level with tears coming up. And I don't understand this music, but it just speaks to my soul, and I just feel like it opens my heart in the hugest way. So, yeah, it's that ancient language. There's this understanding of the harmonics of nature. And by the chanting of these sacred syllables, you feel a connection to the oneness here on the planet. And I think that's what people are really sensing when they listen to this kind of music.
When you teach this course in women's sacred world music, this choir that you're putting together, is drumming also part of it?
That's my plan, is to bring in some traditional drumming. Yes, down the line, but we're going to begin with the voice And this choir is going to be quite unique as far as people think of a choir and they think of, oh, they're going to learn their part from a piece of music that's written. But the way I have learned sacred traditional music from Japan is that it's an oral tradition, and it's done in a call and response fashion. And you know, sacred music way back then was learned so that it was memorized, so that it became learning from the heart instead of through the mind. So we're going to approach it that way and really work with things like sacred text and mantras and sacred melodies that come from India.
So it's not just limited to music of Japan.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to go from Japan to Tibet. I've been involved with a Tibetan spiritual singer named Yangjin Lamu for the past 4 years. And so we incorporate Tibetan music. We also are going to bring in Lithuanian traditional music. And I just returned from a trip to the Baltic nations where I went on a cultural exchange with the Santa Fe Indian School poetry team, the spoken word team that was led by Timothy McLaughlin. And I went there as kind of a chaperone, but also their song coach. I helped them to, the three Navajo students and one Tana Autumn Nation student, to arrange their songs so that they could present them in the Baltic nations. And I learned about the rich song traditions there and how those people gained their independence from the Soviet regime by singing, coming together collectively and singing. So their music is so rich. And there were several singers there that I met, and they shared the way of the chant, the meditative music there. And so I'm going to work in some of that with the choir.
You have an example of that you've brought. Shall we play a little bit of it?
Sure. Yeah, it's called It's You. It's a song that I just wrote the past five months ago, and I incorporate some Lithuanian chant at the end of the song.
So maybe we'll listen to at least that part of the song.
Yes.
Okay, here we go. We're talking to Mari Sato about sacred music.
Dio takanare, Dio takanare, Dio ta.
Music of Mari Sato. Now, what does it mean for you to incorporate something like Lithuanian chant, which is maybe not your native culture, into your own songwriting?
Well, I've found on my journey of doing sacred music that I can be a bridge from the traditional sacred music from almost anywhere with a way of humble respect for lineage, and taking these songs and and working my songwriting kind of around them. The song that you just heard, It's You, was inspired at the mountain. And the traditional chant from Lithuania says, "Oh, sacred mountain, Diyu takal nali, Diyu takal nali." So I connected them in that way. And I've been doing that with my Japanese chanting and folk songs as well, just weaving them into some of my songs. When I find a tiny connection, whether it be, you know, inspired, I wrote the song at the mountain, or it's a song of someone longing, I will look for songs in other cultures and weave them in.
It seems like there's sacred mountains everywhere that there's mountains.
That's right, yes.
How did the Indian students respond to being in Lithuania and beholding that whole new cultural experience?
Wow. I think it profoundly transformed them. They're all young, teenage age, 15 to 21 was the age range. And upon returning and their reflection of their journey there, they, you know, the Baltic nations, from Estonia to Latvia to Lithuania, has a strong sense of cultural identity and keeping their traditional ways. And so when the native students saw that kind of pride in their cultural traditional ways, I think it inspired them to even go deeper into their own traditions and have an appreciation for it. And they talked about wanting to go speak with their grandmothers and grandfathers and learn more and more and really hold that sacred to them, like they saw with the youth in we had some amazing experiences in Lithuania with a folk music group there, all youth that are singing the traditional songs and doing the dances. And it was just so beautifully done from a place of real identity that it was very inspiring for them. Yeah.
I think another thing that's inspiring, in addition to the music itself, is the fact that people are singing together. It's not some kind of isolated iPod culture or even a nightclub culture, which in some cases can be unified, but
yeah,
sometimes not.
It was incredible. There was a show, the first show we did, where at the end there was opening for question and answer, and a girl stood up and said, "We'd like to share a song with you." And she just started singing, and then the whole entire audience joined in. It's like they can all sing because they've just been doing it and kept it up. They hold the largest collection of folk songs I hear in the world. They're recorded. And they're really holding them sacred. Yeah, but it's very powerful to sing in a group setting with an intention, you know, of raising, you know, consciousness to making change, positive change. It's the most powerful thing. Yeah.
You've also traveled to Australia, also studying sacred music?
Well, I ended up meeting Aboriginal elders from the Spinifex tribe on that trip, and didgeridoo players, Japanese didgeridoo players of all things, actually.
In Australia,
Australia.
Japanese didgeridoo players.
Yeah, and I sang in a world music festival while I was there. But the primary purpose of that trip was to go there and kind of become a new mother. I had just had my child, and I really just took my time to enjoy the nature of Australia, meeting some Aboriginal people, writing some songs while I was there, and it's beautiful, very ancient land, yeah.
Now you are going to be leading this Santa Fe Women's Sacred World Music Choir, and so all sorts of things, Afro-Brazilian invocations, Celtic music, American gospel hymns, medieval, modern, all sorts of things. What kind of experience are you looking for in people who join you in this project?
A collective experience. We are going to focus on the things like breath, tone, and community. That those are my three main focuses for this group. And so what I'm expecting is for these women to be willing to participate in creating the sacred community choir. We're gonna have, you know, I call it points of entry with sacred text or mantra, and then I'm gonna invite the women to create spontaneous composition through listening, call and response, listening, and working with the natural harmony of nature, harmonics that are in nature, like the perfect fifth, and
right,
that kind of thing. Yeah.
How many people are you looking for in this group?
30.
30?
Yeah.
Do they have to be able to, for example, sing in tune? Is there an audition?
Not necessarily. And then many people who think they don't sing in tune actually do when they relax enough. So I can help people to find the proper tuning and to learn how to rest into their breath. And I don't think that's going to be a problem at all. If anybody, especially those people who are a little bit nervous of singing, but they have this driving desire to sing, should show up for this.
And this starts on
February 25th, there will be Thursday nights. The choir is from 5 to 6:30, and then I will offer another class from 7 to 8:30 on the same nights, called The Sound Journeys, Discovery of the Authentic Voice, and it's a vocal meditation practice, and we'll be using sacred music from around the world and working with tuning and breathing and chanting. And those two classes will be held at the Center for Spiritual Living on Camino de las Marques.
And to register, people can call 505-660-2526. Mari Sato is a vocalist, musician, and teacher, and Santa Fe Women's Sacred World Music Choir starts in about a week. They can also go to madisato.com, M-A-D-I-S-A-T-O. Madi, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your music.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. Tomorrow, all sorts of good stuff. Robert Knott will be with us. Linda Siegel will be with us. It's Animal Friday with Bill Hutcherson, and we'll be hearing about a wonderful play called Love Letters, just in time for Valentine's Day. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista.